listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And today we are going to be reviewing Lock and Key Volume 2 Head Games by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. And Three Story, The Secret History of the Giant Man by Matt Kent. First one we'll start on is Three Story by Matt Kent. And this essentially follows the story of a guy that doesn't stop growing. And the three stories are a shift of perspective.
Right. It's a play on words because he gets to be roughly the size of a three-story building, or at least that's where the intersection of all these stories happen, is when he's at three stories tall. But also, it is three stories of three women's relationships with him.
Yeah. And so the first one starts out with his mother remembering his father.
Right.
And his father's experience in World War
II.
And how it was when he came home, or, I mean, how it was with the boy growing up and the father not coming home.
Right.
He dies over him in World War II.
And I thought this was a really interesting way to start the story, to tell you the truth, because I hated the mother.
Yeah.
The mother was I have notes on how I felt about her. I've got bitter, bitch, passive aggressive, trying to be quote-unquote sad and lonely, but comes across as petty and making herself out to be the victim. I mean, I hated this woman. Maybe she reminded me of my grandmother. God rest her soul. But, I mean, I don't know what it was. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot about this character that I found appealing. And to have such a negative feeling for me about this storyteller, it was really hard for me. I mean, I knew there was going to be three separate stories, but, you know, for me, that's the first story, is this just vindictive bitch who takes out all of her, you know, feelings. I mean, she's mad that her husband got killed in World War II and left her a widow. And she takes it out on her son in a passive-aggressive form. And I was like, my God, what a miserable, horrible existence. And that's how the book starts.
I didn't get that strong of a vibe from it.
Your grandmother must have been nicer than mine. I don't know. But
I didn't really have a relationship with my grandmother, so I don't know what it was. But I didn't think that this was a likable person, really. Uh-huh. But I did not have such a visceral response to it that...
Oh, man.
That made me angry.
Oh, I could not believe how she treated him, the things she said to him, the things she said about him. You know, the way she treated him when he left to go to college. I mean...
Where are you seeing these things? Because I...
Let's see.
I felt that she felt that this boy was the only thing that she had left of her husband, and that as eventually he was going to do, he was growing up and going to, you know, leave her and detach himself from her, as is the normal way of growing up.
Yeah,
And I did not get any of these, like, harsh negative feelings.
Oh, really?
I definitely got the feeling that she wasn't happy about him growing up and detaching, and that she was going to be that she was probably an overly protective mother. But I didn't get any of these.
Well, I'm on
vindictive.
Here I am on page 34 and 35. So page 34 and 35.
Okay.
Craig, her son, has a girlfriend. So we're in high school now. And, he's got a girlfriend, and the narration is, I was the hat check girl they walk by on the way to the rest of their lives. She's referring to a Cary Grant movie. It didn't mean anything. It ended up being like an early chapter in a long novel, the early chapter that you forget. And she just seemed like she was taking it personally that he, you know, that
see,
he was
getting
the attention.
I didn't see that she was taking it personal. I saw it as she was saddened that he was moving on and that really he was taking on a life of his own, as adults do. And so I did not see these negative feelings. I definitely felt that she didn't feel good about it. But, I mean, the artwork does suggest it in that second panel where her face is dark and, mm-hmm. and she looks pissed off.
And then later...
Maybe I just didn't catch on to more subtle hints.
And then later on, you know, when he... you know, they invite her to the wedding, she won't come to the wedding. When he drives away, I'm trying to find the pages, you know, as I'm just flipping through and talking to you here. But as they drive away, for him to go to college, it's like, you know, if you leave now, don't come back. I think she says that to him as he's driving away, in one of the flashbacks. And then, yeah, she tries to, you know, they send her an invitation to the wedding. She doesn't come to the wedding. You know, she just doesn't seem to want to be any part of her life. It says on page 101, we invited only closest friends, some family, and Craig's mom. And you see the picture where it says Craig's mom, there's a bottle, a glass, and an unopened invitation there. Mm. And, you know, I wish I could find some of these other ones, but I just, like I said, this person, and again, maybe it's because it really touched home. I mean, I you know, I'm not going to drag up my whole, you know, horrible family childhood here, but, you know, my relationship with my grandmother, my mom's mom, was very similar, where there was lots of, you know, just snide, biting comments that, you know, made you feel like there was just, you know, if you don't do this exactly the way that I'm saying, you don't love me.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I felt there was a lot of that from the mom here, from the mom, that she was mad. I mean, even from the very, very beginning, where it was like, where is it? You sent me roses, but you didn't know me long enough to know that I didn't like roses.
I thought that was the wife. Oh, no.
That's the mom, page 13. And the roses, you didn't know me long enough to know I never really liked roses, but there they were. And I think that she had, I mean, on the one hand, the first time I read it, I was like, well, she's got this whole idea, you know, because she says, you know, like a magic trick. You know, they arrived like a magic trick. And how, you know, so the first time I read it, it was kind of like, wow, that's so nice. You
know? I know, and that's what I took too, because it looks like she's trying to paint the roses on the first couple of pages.
But then why would she point out, but I didn't like them, you know? But then the show ended, the magician disappeared, and I was left on the stage, still expected to perform. That's what she says on page 19. And I just wanted the curtain to drop on everything. And I just, you know, like I said, page 22. Ma, I can dress myself. Okay, you don't have to yell. And like I said, I mean, maybe it's just my, like I said, I mean, maybe this is just my reaction to it, because it just strikes as a character that I know
from my own life. I can see where you're coming from. I mean, now that you're pointing these out, these individual things, I can see where you're coming from. I didn't take it nearly as strong as that. I took it as she was a very lonely and bitter person, but I didn't hate her.
Oh, man. Yeah, no.
Wish her death.
I don't wish her death, but, you know, page 41, she's calling. Is Craig there? It's Marge, his mother. I'm sure he's busy. Too busy to talk, I guess. He missed his grandmother's birthday. I just wanted to. It's too far for me. He can't afford to take a week away. I see. Click. And just hangs up. And it was that kind of thing where, especially when we see later on how incredibly difficult it was for her son to have any semblance of a normal relationship with anybody due to his size.
Yeah.
The fact that she could just, I don't know, give up on him and write him off so easily. I mean, the fact that a parent could do that to a child just, you know, that was so painful and so hard to see that, you know,
yeah,
that she would just, I don't know, not love her son enough to see that he was going through something so, you know, what seems like incredibly wonderful on the surface, but as you see, it's tragic.
Yeah.
And for her to be mad about the whole thing and feel like she's somehow taking the brunt of it.
Yeah.
At least that's the way I took it when I was.
So you feel like she was very egocentric.
Very egocentric and very, like I said, passive aggressive.
That is really bitchy because this is obviously a story about him. What the hell is she doing stealing the spotlight?
Exactly. So, you know, it's... Yeah, for me, that was... It was a strange and...
But I feel like what makes this book really work is the complexity of the relationships that he has with both of these women. Mm-hmm. And because... His relationship with his wife is a very complex one.
Page 76 is my last piece of evidence. But no, I...
You're still going on about this?
Still going on about it. I hated that woman.
Man, I thought we were moving on, but all right. Page 76.
Can you ever really move on from family issues? Family issues will be with you forever. Now, I agree. You know, he has very complex relationships with these women, and that's what I liked so much about this story, is that you go from such a, you know, big character of this mom, like I said, someone that I had such a huge reaction to, you know, an entirely different character with the woman who ends up being his wife. I mean, she is a fully different character cut from an entirely different cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a great writing ability on his part to be able to do that, to be able to craft an entirely different character.
Because really, if you think about it, he, the giant man, is kind of a blank slate as a character. Mm-hmm. And there's no definable characteristics really about him other than his size. And so I feel like you're really able to place yourself into him and experience his relationships throughout the book through his eyes, because there's no definable characteristics of him.
Yeah, for it being, you know, the secret history of the giant man, we know so little about him.
Yeah.
I mean, we know his life, but we never get inside of his head. This is not a first person.
Yeah.
Account, which I think was so, I don't know, such a unique take on it.
Yeah, definitely.
And so, yeah, you see him through three different eyes. You see him from the eyes of the mother who's very resentful of him. You see him from the eyes of the woman who would be his wife who loves him, but... Oh, I mean, it's all the challenges of a relationship.
Magnified.
Exactly. And then finally through the eyes of the daughter who never really gets to know her dad.
Yeah.
And so she almost idealizes him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was, you know, three very, very different perspectives. And like you said, on this blank slate, on this person who can be so many different things to so many different people.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, it was a really unexpected take on it.
Yeah, like you said, unexpected, because I guess I didn't really have any expectations mm-hmm. for this. I didn't really know what it was going to be.
Right.
But it was really surprising by the time I got through the end of it and reflected on it and thought about what the story actually was, in that our main character really wasn't a character. He was more of a figurehead of somebody, just a placeholder, really. Mm-hmm. And it's really about these three women in his life.
Right.
And these three generations of women mm-hmm. in his family.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, stands in for so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, he stands in, like you said, for that natural progression of a child growing up and leaving home. How he stands in for a relationship between two people. And I think she even says it, that his wife says it, that there was a very brief period of time where everything was perfect.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and she's referring to their sex life, but it's metaphorically
yeah.
how in every relationship there's a very, very brief period of time where everything's perfect. And a really good relationship, that brief period of time is brief in the cosmic sense.
Yeah. You know?
And your lifetime is wonderful, but in most relationships there's a period of time where everything's wonderful, and then everything else is some degree closer or further to that.
Yeah.
And you can see their relationship devolve.
And really, it's more like their lives separate and they're pursuing different goals. They're not pursuing the same goals together.
Right, anymore. And I think that, you know, despite the fact that he's three stories tall, his concerns, at least as he explains them, is that he's concerned about providing for his family.
Yeah.
He's taking jobs that he doesn't necessarily want.
Mm-hmm.
Because he feels like he has to be the breadwinner for the family.
Sure.
And she has an architecture career, but is constantly being overshadowed by her husband.
Yeah.
And struggles to find her own identity.
Yep.
And, you know, regardless of the fact if you're married to a guy who's three stories tall or a guy who's 5'4", I mean, those are the kinds of real problems that real people have.
I felt like it was a metaphor for celebrity, where he becomes so big and so overarching and people demand his attention and pull him in so many different ways that it pretty much destroys their life together, because she's not experiencing the same thing. And you often see when couples are together and then one of them gets really famous, like, they almost always break up shortly after that. And that's, I think, why celebrities tend to usually, you know, couple with other celebrities, because they both have these experiences and these demands and these same pressures.
Right. Yeah, and I thought that it was, I thought that this was such a natural progression for this relationship that I didn't feel was natural with the mother and the son.
Uh-huh.
I thought that the mother and the son, like I said, I could not believe her relationship with him, or at least her feelings for him. With the wife, I mean, she goes through such a period of loneliness,
but
she never stops loving him. Even at the end, when the decision is made for him to leave.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing she does is she pays a farmer to go and plow under part of his field in a giant message that her husband can read that says, "We love you."
Yeah.
I mean, it was not about, it was never a, you know, that she didn't love him. It was just that their lives were going in so many different directions.
And they weren't compatible anymore.
No.
And not on an emotional level, but mm-hmm. on a lifestyle level.
Right. And again, you know, you can look at this literally or you can look at it metaphorically. They were having so many problems communicating that even when, you know, they were trying, they still couldn't do it. The chasm was too big. He was too loud and she was too quiet and he couldn't see what she was writing.
Yeah.
You know, even when they're, you know, they think they're making a real effort, the best effort just cannot overcome those kinds of difficulties. And so yeah, it works on a couple of levels here.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the third story is the story of the daughter much later on. I mean, she's an adult now, working as a journalist.
Yeah.
Going on the search for whatever happened to her father.
And really trying to find out who he was as a person.
And I thought that was, I don't know, that one was the one that I understood it on the metaphorical level a lot more than I got it on the realistic level.
Yeah, I did as well. And, I mean, I don't know if this is indicative of it, but if you look at what the size of the story is, it's maybe a tenth of the other two stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, I mean, the third story, I guess I feel like, isn't as important on a grand scale of the overall story.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's more about, because really what we're seeing is his life in the previous stories, and we're just kind of seeing snapshots of where he's been and what's kind of happened to him. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't really his life, because his life was who he surrounded himself with and who his relationships were.
Right.
And it's really more of him and the complete loneliness and solitariness that he feels,
mm-hmm.
you know, being completely unable to relate with humanity.
Right. It's almost that Dr. Manhattan thing from The Watchmen.
Totally. You know, I got that same feeling that
he's a part yet so separate.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's almost a physical embodiment of that, because he gets so big that we're almost particles to him, you know.
Right. Well, and you see him as a I don't know, as a geological piece in the end, practically.
Uh-huh.
You know, talking about how there were, you know, piles of dead birds that had been swatted away like insects.
Yeah.
And, you know, he see him holding out his hand and birds perching on him. I mean, all these, and where he had stepped, now they were big swimming holes. I mean, things like that, you know, yeah, you see him as a force of nature.
Yeah, yeah.
More so. But
I think that's a good term.
But I think that's where I had the problem with the, like I said, with that last piece, was that, you know, for his mother, she had been trying so hard to hold on to her husband, the memory of her husband, through her son.
Mm-hmm.
She had such high hopes that she would somehow regain a little bit of her husband through her son.
Mm-hmm.
And was so disappointed when she didn't. Well, now we've moved on, and now we have her son's offspring and her, you know, this daughter trying to, I don't know, figure out, yeah, who the dad was, trying to figure out who this person was, and almost reclaim some of him for herself, because she, you know, they left when she was so small.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I kind of want to know what she got out of it. I mean, what was it that she, I don't know, what was her takeaway? I mean, I know that her takeaway was that he was trying at the very end to go home to the people who had loved him.
Yeah.
But I guess, what kind of legacy did she see him as? You know, what did she see him, what did she see his life as being, I guess, is what I want to know. I mean, because if we live on through our children, if we, you know, our impact is felt by the next generation, what was his impact? What was the overall place in history of this giant man? Or at least, what was the place in her history of this giant man?
Yeah, there's really no reflection by that character. And I feel like that's what I had the hardest time with the third story with,
mm-hmm.
is it wasn't really trying to understand his history and her relationship to him in that history. It was really just trying to understand what he had done after leaving her mother.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's where I had the hardest time with it.
You know, I guess if we took the celebrity metaphor further out, you know, once a celebrity is used up, you know, yeah. if you will, for, you know, 99% of them, their impact was their 15 minutes of fame. Uh-huh. And then years down the road, you get either a, you know, where are, you know, VH1, where are they now type thing, where someone goes and finds them and you find out that they're, you know, I don't know, living off of their 15 minutes of fame and, you know, yeah. holding down a job as an accountant or something, or you see them as a quick blurb in the, you know, obits or the crime section, or, you know, something like that. That their resonance, their long term cultural impact is next to none. Mm-hmm. That you know, they used it all up in that 15 minutes. And I felt like this guy had potentially so much more than that. And so that's why I was so surprised that in the end his body, this physical huge body completely disappeared as well.
Yeah.
I mean, she ended up having to, you know, go to the government and have, you know, get, well, it wasn't even the government, I mean, it was a former CIA guy.
Yeah.
Get tracking devices from him to even find her father. And, you know, yeah, he just faded away. Which I think is pretty ironic considering how he had been in the spotlight his entire
yeah.
life, more or less.
Yeah. So what'd you think about the art?
You know, I think that if you like Matt Kent's art, you're going to like Three Story. And I like Matt Kent's art, so...
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a very stylized type of art.
Right.
And so I could see how somebody mm-hmm. might not like it, but I really love yeah. his art.
It's a little bit different than Super Spy. You uh-huh. know, if you've read Super Spy, the art style is slightly different. Not, you know, not that it's unrecognizable as... you know, as Matt Kent, but it's slightly different. If you like Matt Kent's art, then you will like this. I like it. I liked the colors. It's got
yeah.
a real watercolor and colored pencil type feel to it. Lots of nice tones to it that really makes it feel... I don't know, feel like you're looking at a different world, the kind of world where this could happen.
Yeah.
You know, kind of world, you know, they set it up pretty early that the world's tallest man is, you know, previously was 9 feet tall, which uh-huh. is already taller than any, you know, world's tallest man that we've had.
Yeah.
So you're already getting a feeling like you're in a slightly different world.
Yeah.
Not, you know... but believable. You know, the colors make it believable. And it's the same sort of, you know, tonal wash that Matt Kent's stories have.
Yeah, so. I really love his use of watercolor.
Mm-hmm.
I really like comics that use watercolor, and Matt Kent does a great job
right.
with it. And so I love the art. My favorite page actually is 111. And I don't know why, but for some reason, I just love this series where he's sitting on the ship, dragging his feet, and then he kind of stands up and is looking. And as he says it, he says, "When I stand up, it's a beautiful and lonely perspective. I feel like I'm staying the same."
Mm-hmm.
And I just love those three panels that make up that page.
Yeah. For me, it was page 135. And, you know, maybe it's because I've got two little girls. But it's, you know, just three panels of him trying really hard to have a, you know, quiet, loving moment with her, with his daughter, and she's just so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
He never actually touches her on these three pages or these three panels. She'll touch him. He'll get close to her,
yeah.
But you can tell that he's just so scared he's going to hurt her, that, you know, he just sees her as being so fragile to him,
yeah,
that he can't touch her. And just the look in his eyes in that second panel, I mean, it's just, it's love and at the same time it's sadness that he just can't, he can't have that intimacy and that relationship with his own daughter.
Yeah. That's a great one. I also like the ad for Giant Smokes.
Yeah.
That's a great one. It's kind of like an old 50s ad for cigarettes, but it shows the giant man standing next to the Eiffel Tower, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And there were some fun ones. Yeah. I mean, there was some real fun play with it that you would think that it would be logical. I mean, if there were... And I think that's what I like about it, is that Matt Kent took a pretty logical approach to this.
Yeah.
That if there was a giant man, he would need clothes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Hagar Company, you know, agreed to sponsor him and basically make him clothes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all these things that he does basically to stay, you know, alive, you
yeah.
know, because he eats so much and he needs clothes and all these things. And, you know, Matt Kent does a great job of just making it be realistic and applying the logic. How, like I said, I mean, how this would be seemingly a fantastic, wonderful thing to be the world's tallest man and to be three stories tall, but the logistics behind it are just,
yeah, he does a great job of really making it realistic to live and be
yeah,
that tall.
Exactly. Exactly. The design of the book is striking also.
Yeah.
Because, again, you get the real sense of how freaky it must be to be three stories tall, where you see him. It's a cutout of a living room with just this giant eye looking in. And it's very reminiscent of the original King Kong.
Oh,
movie,
yeah, yeah.
Where just the eye is looking in, and so you can tell that, I mean, on the one hand, he's, you know, physically outside of the rest of the world. He's metaphorically outside of the rest of the world, and then how he and the rest of the world kind of see him as a monster and a freak.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, great design for the book.
That was $20, wasn't it?
Yeah, from Dark Horse, and absolutely beautiful. I was surprised it was by Dark Horse. I mean, I really expected this to be from
Top Shelf
or Ad House or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. They did a wonderful job with it. The production value on this is out of this world.
Yeah, this is a great quality book and a good story. And mm-hmm. if you like Matt Kent's artwork, I mean, amazing
yeah.
artwork.
The only problem I had with it is I think there's a spelling error on page 23. It says, the scarf is supposed to disappear, but something goes wrong. It doesn't disappear. It's still painfully, awkwardly there. And I don't know this idea. I think it's the scar is supposed to disappear. And, you know.
Isn't it supposed to be the magic trick?
Yeah, but where's the reference to the scar? Scarf.
I don't know. I thought that earlier she talked about it making the scarf disappear or something.
Well, so it's like you disappearing and the magic trick. But then the show ended and the magician disappeared and I was left on stage still expected to perform and I just wanted the curtain to drop on everything. And there was never a reference to a scarf, and so I thought it was the scar was supposed to disappear. But yeah, maybe it's the scarf that's the magic. You're supposed to have the scarf disappear in the magic trick. I don't know. But that was my one thing. It was kind of like, is there just a mislettering here somewhere, and...
I don't think so. I think that's the way it's supposed to be.
Think so?
Yeah.
So there you go. Yeah, definitely. This is one. Pick it up. Find it. Enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a good book.
Great.
Our next book is Lock and Key Head Games. This is the second book in the Lock and Key series. And I actually wrote up a written review of this on our blog, of the first one. Mm-hmm. On our blog. And so go check that out. We both really enjoyed the first one.
We did.
And it leaves you absolutely wanting more. He invites just enough of a fantasy element and just enough of a horror element to not make this a fantasy or a horror book. Right. But to be really enjoyable. And mystery, too, really.
Right.
So what this is about a house called Lock Manor, or Key House, I guess.
Yeah, the family is the Lock family, and so yeah. This is Key House. Yeah.
And so it's about his father who grew up in the house and had knowledge of these keys that would open otherworldly things, like one key, if you go through one door, you turn into a ghost. Another one changes your gender. And so there's all these different keys, but he kind of forgot about them as he grew up.
Right.
And moved on and created his family. And one of his son's classmates, and his son is a teenager in high school, and one of his classmates comes and murders the father and is about to murder the rest of the family when the mother kills one of them and the other one just gets arrested and goes to an insane asylum.
No, because remember they go down into the basement and Tyler beats him with a brick.
I thought that was the second time when he came back.
Oh, when he came back?
Yeah. So the first time, I think somehow they get away or whatever. I don't remember.
Yeah.
The first one too well. Mm-hmm. But anyways, the story is that one of the guys is in an insane asylum for the criminally insane. Right. And they end up going back to Key House to kind of regroup as a family.
Right.
And just kind of live there with
the uncle,
her brothers, or his brother, right?
Right.
The father's brother, Duncan. So Tyler's the son's uncle.
Tyler's the son's uncle.
Tyler, the son's.
Son. Yeah.
Tyler, comma the son, uncle.
Right.
And so as they're staying there, they're starting to, the youngest son discovers the keys and starts playing with the keys.
Right.
And then shows Tyler.
Yeah. Bodhi, the youngest son, the first key he discovers in the first book is he discovers and there's a handy guide to these keys in the back, which I thought was pretty cool. He discovers the ghost key.
Yeah.
That basically you put it in the door, you turn the lock, you open the door, you step through the door, and your spirit leaves your body.
Yeah.
And you can go anywhere, and also it appears that you can go any time in your own lifetime, because the Bodhi travels back to the day that everyone was killed in the first book. And then he also finds in the previous book
the anywhere key. Where you can open a door and walk through into anywhere.
Right, and at the end of the last book, the ghost key and the anywhere key end up in the power of sort of the evil bad guy. It's this combination character of Zach Wells, Lucas Caravaggio, and his sort of main name is Dodge. What gets confusing is that somehow Dodge has ended up with the gender key and switches his gender so that he's actually a she in the well.
Yeah.
And so there's I think what I'm really getting at with this is that
you
this
need to
is
read
a
the first
lousy
story.
Book to jump in yeah. in the middle. You need to read the first book.
Yeah, if you don't, I don't know how you could follow
possibly along. Get in on this. And that's, you know, that's the thing is that, you know, I haven't picked up the first book since I borrowed it from you to read it a
and
while
I didn't,
ago.
I should have reread the first book before reading this.
But it does, you need a base level of understanding mm-hmm. of the story. Once you have that base level, though, this book reads pretty easily.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I needed to reread the right. first book. As long as you understand that there's keys out there and that Dodge is actually like a spirit or whatever trapped in the well and right. some of the other elements of the story, you can just run with this book.
Right.
But it's having that actual base knowledge, like you said.
Right. So this one, this volume revolves around the head key.
Yes.
Which, I have to say that I did not enjoy this as much as I enjoyed the first volume, because the head key was annoying. It was, and it's like you said, it's a balance between fantasy and horror. And I thought that the head key, or at least the way it was portrayed, or at least the result of it, the way it was portrayed was the kind of thing that was very young.
Yeah, it was cutesy.
Yeah, basically what happens is the possessor of the head key can see in the base of people's skulls an old-fashioned keyhole, and then yeah. can physically insert this key into that base, turn it, and the top of the head magically disappears, and
you can cram stuff in, and you so can, you can put a textbook in and know everything that's in the textbook,
right?
Or you can take stuff out, memories and other yeah. things,
and everything. And it's not this gross, gory, the hot top of the head pops off and you see brains and blood and all that. No, it's this happy little cranium that yeah. when you're looking at the person head on, and then you go and you peek in their head, and each person has something different in their head. I mean, yeah. every person's world is different, which I thought was kind of cool, that idea that everybody's different in their head.
But it was very cutesy. You're right.
Yeah, it just,
and especially when you pull something out and it has its own personality, and,
right.
and things, and that the part that I found hard to go along with was that you could just, like, she could reach in, Kinsey, his sister, could reach into her head and pull out the part that makes her cry.
Right.
And it's just something easy. Oh, that's the part I want, and pull it out.
Right.
Whatever. I'm buying into like everything else in the story,
right.
but it was like really cutesy, and then they had their own personalities, and I just
yeah.
I didn't enjoy it.
No, and it was the kind of thing where I liked the practical application of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it lent itself to some really interesting storytelling possibilities. Like you said, the ability to cram an entire book into your head. The ability to physically remove memories, which is an important part of this story.
Yeah.
Dodge, Zach Wells, Lucas Caravaggio, whoever, whatever we want to call that character, spends a good deal of time in this story trying to get rid of people's memories of him. And so it has a very good practical application, but I just thought that the execution of it artistically was not something that matched the overall tone of the story. It was very jarring, very, like I said, just very distracting. Took me out of the story
yeah.
for quite a bit.
I could see that. This book overall, though, I found extremely enjoyable, and I'm still on board with the story.
Oh, yeah. I think that this did a great job of even deepening the mysteries.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it deepened and made me want to know more, because as you look through the art in this, you know, as you're reading along, there are other keys.
Yeah.
And we've seen other keys in this, you know, in volume one and in volume two, keys that aren't even in the back here, you know, in the glossary or uh-huh. you know, thing. We've seen them throughout the story, so we know they're there. The characters don't know that they are there, but we know that they are there. And it just makes you wonder, okay, now what's going to happen? And this yeah. story gets the introduction of a new location as well. You get the introduction of
that little cove.
The drowning cove or yeah. whatever it is. And looking in the back, you know, excerpts from the diary of Benjamin Pierce Locke, 1757 to 1799, there's reference to it in there. So we know that there is a history of something happening in this place, and then yeah. it ties into the well, because with the echo key, we see that, you know, Benjamin Locke said something about he rose from the well like a spirit and yet was living, he was living flesh, although he had died in the drowning caves not 6 weeks before. And we know that Dodge, you know, in his female form, was in the well.
Yeah.
And we know that Dodge and two other people disappeared when, at the time of Locke, the father, was in high school. They were all high school friends. Yeah. Two other kids
and disappeared. And Duncan was gonna go down in the cove with him, and he told Duncan, you know, he was too young to
come. Caravaggio, Dodge, whatever you want to call him, sent him away, said he was too young, they were gonna do adult things or grown up things down there. So yeah, it added and made the it just made it a little bit more believable. It made the whole sort of
It really area. Fleshed out a whole history of yeah. this world, besides just this house
right.
and this time period.
Right.
It really deepened and made much more visceral the story.
Right. Oh, I agree. This made it, like I said, I mean, aside from the representation of the power of the head key, which I really didn't enjoy, everything else about this story deepened it and really expanded the world in which they live.
And in a believable way. One of the surprises in this story is that we find out that Duncan's gay. And I really loved that he was a character first, and then it's almost an accident that we find out that this character's gay. In other words, he's just another person to us.
Right.
So many times I feel like we're presented with gay characters and we know that they're gay right off, and that's a part of their character.
Right.
Whereas Duncan's a fully fleshed character that we don't even know is gay, but have an idea of who he is until this story, and we find out this is just another piece of who he is.
Right.
Which is really the way it is in real life.
Right. I thought that the handling of the anti-gay people was a little heavy-handed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, how many times have you been in a bar where people have been drinking and they just start mouthing off and saying some really ridiculous shit? I mean, it's that kind of thing.
I didn't feel like it was heavy-handed because I grew up in a really small town being a punk rocker and mm-hmm. and a skateboarder. And, like, I used to get called skate fag, like, daily occurrence, like skating down the street yeah. just because I had a skateboard. It didn't even mean I was gay. I can't even imagine being gay in that right. town. Like, I mean, I don't see this as being especially heavy-handed in a small town right. environment, because I dealt with that.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I thought it was a very, very realistic portrayal of being gay for a person that really being gay is one aspect of a person's personality.
Sure. And
up until this point, there was no reason for that aspect of his personality to come out. When it came out, it was a wow, big pun. When it came out, it was a logical and reasonable reason for it to happen. It wasn't, you know, oh, we're gonna, you know, stick this on.
Every piece of this story has unfolded in a logical and natural way. Right. I haven't felt put on. And besides, like you said about the cutesy handling of the head key, everything else, nothing has jarred me out of the storytelling.
Right. There was not necessarily an introduction. Well, maybe it was an introduction. It's been a little while since I've read Volume 1. But we see Ellie, who is... She was part of that high school gang from, you know, 25 years ago or whatever. That was, you know, the first locked, you know, that whole high school gang when Wells, Dodge, Caravaggio was there the first time. Ellie Wells was part of that group. She's now a teacher at that high school. And as Dodge is back, he is staying with her and pretending to be her nephew, I believe.
Yeah.
We see her autistic son in this. And I, like I said, I don't know if he was in the first volume. I don't recall. But he plays a fairly major role in this volume.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how his character, what role this character plays. Because on the one hand, he interacts with the world around him, but he interacts through a lens of these two action figures that he's playing with.
Yeah.
So everything that he receives from the world and puts out into the world comes basically either through a G.I. Joe or through a Buzz Lightyear type, you know, space robot thing.
Master Chief.
There you go. So it's... and when Dodge is going around trying to erase everyone's memories, when he's in possession of the head key, he realizes that there's no lock at the base of the sun's skull. He can't erase that memory.
Yeah.
And so he's stuck with, you know, what to do next. Because on the one hand, you know, how much impact can this kid have? I mean, everything he says comes out as, you know, yes, sir, no, sir. You know, there's been a break-in at the barracks. I mean, that kind of thing. But at the same time, he has successfully managed to erase everybody's memory of him, with the exception of this one kid. And you've got to, you know, I've got the feeling that that's sort of that one little loose end that just can't be tied up.
Yeah, I mean, you know that kid's coming back in the third volume and somehow impacting the story.
Right, but to have it all hinging on an autistic kid is a neat way, because it leaves so many storytelling possibilities open there.
That's what I love about this book, is I have no idea where it's headed.
No.
And he leaves this kind of clue in this volume where you get to see the Omega key. It shows all of the keys in the back and a little schematic, and you get to see what they all do. And then the Omega key has its explanation ripped out, and you can't really see what it exactly it is. So it's this teaser for this key that's going to be coming up, you know?
Right.
And so he just dangles all these things out there for you, and I'm just eating it up. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that, I mean, I got to the end of this and was like, more, you know? Yeah. I need to have more. And at the same time, I really felt like this was not filler. You know, so often, Volume 2 is just kind of a filler. It's the bridge between the introduction and the conclusion. And I felt like a lot of really important stuff happened in this. I felt like there was some great character development.
Yeah, when there wasn't plot, when the plot wasn't moving forward, there was great character development going on, and we were learning more about people and their relationships. And so I felt like every panel and every page and every piece of this book was used to develop the story or the characters. And that's what was really exciting about this book, is it just really pushes the story forward. I never feel like you said, like there's any filler.
Right. I mean, even the parts that you know, you start to wonder a little bit, you know, it's like, okay, how does this directly impact, you know, like the first part. I mean, the very first part deals with at best tertiary character. I mean, it's the professor who was the director of the Shakespearean play that everybody was engaged in 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And you see how his wife dies under mysterious circumstances. I thought it was kind of interesting that she died, she basically drowned, she disappeared in the water, but yet they chalked it up to cancer. I couldn't quite figure out why they would make that decision to chalk it up to cancer.
Hold on. What do you mean she drowned?
Well, she disappeared. She's gone. Prologue. Oh,
I thought that she died of cancer.
Well, she did. Sort of. At least, I don't think she died of cancer. I mean, that's the thing. You got the prologue. And he says, you know, she says she's going to jump in the water and he needs to come and rescue her. And he jumps in and says, how come she's not back up? It's got to be almost 2 minutes, goddammit. Where the hell are you, Callie? And he dives in the water.
Yeah, but then he finds her. It shows on page 28, like him diving into the water and he says, there you are.
Well, yeah, because he's dead. And he finally found her. She's dead. And he's dead.
Oh, I see.
So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm not reading it right. I mean, maybe that was... He's going back to that moment where he, you know, he found her and he's remembering that moment. I mean, sure. Maybe that's it. I just, the way I read it, because it's like, where did, you know, the next thing he's waking up, it's like, where did you go? And all I could think of was, well, she was gone. I mean, where did she go?
I guess I didn't think that she died there.
Uh-huh.
Because it shows a picture of her as the headmaster and she's old.
And see, that was the thing, is that I had a problem with, I you know, flagged it and went, is there a timeline issue here that I'm not understanding? Because, yeah, it says she was the dean of admissions from 79 to 2004, and it talked about how they were young and in love and a multiracial couple in 1965. So, I mean, maybe you're right. I mean, but either way, I mean, you got this tertiary character who was the advisor. You know, I really didn't see what his point was going to be, and then why Dodge goes through all the trouble to kill him and all this, until later on you see that one of the crime scene investigators has pulled out a piece of glass that was left over from where the professor bashed Dodge in the head with it. It's another one of those loose ends that isn't getting tied up in this volume, but that's going to slowly unravel later on. And so again, there's, like you said, there's no filler. I mean, even the fact that he's going to go kill this, you know, third level character here, it's important to the larger story further down the road.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a lost book.
A lost book.
Yes. Like the experience that you get from watching Lost.
There's no filler.
Yeah, it's just all these loose ends being tangled out there, and as soon as one gets wrapped up, two more are left out there.
Right. Yeah, I really thought that, like I said, on the one hand, this gave... This made me ask so many more questions. And at the same time, it tied up so much for me. We start to understand how Dodge came back. You know, how Dodge ended up here, there, and elsewhere. You know, how a little piece of him ended up inside Cali. I mean, all these little things that have been hinted at and talked about are all woven in there. And again, in a very natural, believable, and understandable way, so that it feels realistic to be getting some answers here. But at the same time, the big questions aren't being answered, and there's hints that there's so much more out there. Like I said, the going through and the seeing these keys in different places, sure, letting us know that there are more keys out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is just another great volume in this series.
And yeah. I
always get pissed about reading these because then I realize that I've got like another 8 months or whatever to wait until the next one comes out.
I'm thinking a year. I mean, honestly, if you look
at it... It could be. I don't remember.
Because I don't know if there's one in production right now. I mean, I don't know if... It says, you know, will be continued in Lock and Key Volume 3. The Crown of Shadows, but you know, I don't know if Crown of Shadows is currently in production. So I mean, we're looking at,
well, I think this is a monthly book.
I think it's miniseries is because it says, if you look at the indica up front, it says was originally published as Lock and Key Head Games issues 1-6.
Oh really?
Yep. So I think it comes out as a series of mini-series. Hmm. So, I like I said, I don't know if it's in production. I'll have to check the IDW site and see if it is. But yeah, we're looking at a minimum of 6 months out. More like 8 months to a year. And dang it, I want more. I mean, that's the thing, is I want more. There are some really visually striking things about this. I think that the whole key concept is just a visually striking idea, and all those keys are mysterious and sinister at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great visual that they've you know, latched onto here.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of great things about this book.
So, it was $25 from IDW, hardcover. What do you think? Yes?
Oh, definitely worth it. I mean, the art is gorgeous in it. The production value is gorgeous. I always love the books where you get the little bookmark
right
in it. These are great volumes. They're going to look good on your shelf next to each other.
They are. I agree. They are. You were saying that you're wondering what the omnibus is going to look like. I like these individual volumes. I really do. I think this is a great feel. I mean, just in your hand, it's a great feel.
Yeah.
Like I said, I did not enjoy this one quite as much as I enjoyed the first Lock and Key. And I think it had to do... And I think it was just the visual. That cutesy... depiction of the power of the head key.
Sure. Kind of, it's still a really solid story, though.
It's a solid story, and like I said, the application and the implication of that head key was really important.
Yeah.
And really helped to drive the story forward. And the overall, the art, great.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I said, the first volume, there wasn't anything that yanked me out of it. This volume, there was that piece that yanked me out of it. It still is worth going and picking up. It really is.
Oh yeah, and this is one of the best ongoing series out there.
Yeah,
I mean, for independent, this is like right up there at the top of my list that I'm going to be picking up day one.
Right. When it comes out. This is getting pre-ordered and set aside for me.
Yeah.
To get the next volume.
All right, you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. You can find us on StumptownTradeReview.com.